Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies. I'm your host, Roxanne Panchassi, and today I'm very pleased to be able to speak with historian Elizabeth Foster about her new book, Faith in Empire, Religion, Politics, and Colonial Rule in French Senegal, 1880 to 1940, published by Stanford University Press earlier this year. Hi there, Liz.
Hi. Hi, Roxanne. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm really pleased that you were able to speak with me today about the book.
Great. Well, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk about it.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and what got you interested in working on France and French history in particular.
Sure. I am currently an assistant professor of history at Tufts University. And I think my path to French history started, I think, as it did for many of my colleagues, with early language instruction. I went to a school where I had to start learning French in elementary school. And I had wonderful teachers of French and of history at that school. I actually thanked them in the beginning of my acknowledgments, because I really think they are the people who put me on this eventual path. And when I was in college, I had been debating between doing marine biology and history.
That's quite a choice.
Oddly enough, but I found my history classes so much more compelling than the intro science courses. And I decided a little bit on a whim to do European history, largely because I had the French and I could read it. And then, of course, I was seduced by the amazing historiography, you know, Robert Darton, Lynn Hunt, Mona Ouzouf. Reading all of that as an undergraduate really cemented my interest. But it was that early, you know, exposure to French that made that possible.
And what brought you to the subject of this book in particular, the subject of colonial rule in French Senegal in this period? You know, you cited these sort of early modern revolutionary French texts, but, you know, now work on the late 19th and first half of the 20th century and on empire. Can you say a little bit more about what got you interested in those issues?
Sure. And this is, it's kind of a roundabout story. When I was in college, I spent three summers working on and near the Blackfeet reservation in north central Montana. I went as a student volunteer, and then I worked in a laundry room in Glacier Park. And I saw firsthand, you know, what I consider to be a colonial situation, and was really fascinated with, you know, how the people in the reservation, how the Blackfeet people, you know, were living in the midst of this larger entity, and how they were coping with, you know, preserving their identity and arguing about preserving their identity, and including their religious identity. And this is something that comes out, obviously, in my work, although I don't know that it was conscious at the time. But I was very interested in, you know, evidence of religious syncretism. I saw going to sweat lodges and hearing Hail Marys, for example. And I kind of imported that interest back into my academic work as an undergraduate. And I did my senior thesis was on the colonial exposition in Paris in 1931. So I got interested in those issues in the American context, but then wanted to look at them in the French context. So that's sort of how I got there. And then in terms of getting to getting to Senegal, it was sort of a combination of, you know, as I think it is for many historians, of sources and also, you know, there was interest, but then there's also sort of the source parameters. And I had, like many first books, this book grew out of a dissertation, and I had gone to France in 2003 with the intention of writing something totally different. I was still interested in France and colonialism in West Africa, but I was going to write something about commerce. And I was in Bordeaux, actually, and I was looking at municipal archives in Bordeaux, and I wasn't really finding what I was looking for. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure exactly where I was heading. And I somehow found myself returning to the religious question. And I think it had to do, honestly, that was the fall when the Stasi Commission was looking into the eventual, what became the law on, religious symbols, ostentatious religious symbols. And that was sort of in the air, I guess. And I made a trip one day sort of out of the blue to a diocese library and started poking around and thought, wow, look at all this interesting missionary stuff. And then I called up a missionary archive and, they said, yeah, we have lots of stuff. And I took the train to Paris and there was this wealth of stuff on Senegal in particular. And it really interested me because during this period of the Third Republic, Senegal, as is explained in the book, Senegal had this unique situation where there were four coastal towns where African males who were born there had the right to vote, both for in local and regional elections, but then also to send a deputy to the French National Assembly. And so I became very interested in, what's the relationship between this particular colony and the Metropolitan Republic. So sorry, that was a long answer.
No, that's it's really interesting. One of my favorite parts of doing these interviews is finding out how people come to the work that they do, because it's not something you always get to find out outside of acknowledgments. I wonder if we could just, moving to talk about the book now, and you've sort of gotten us started, but if we could just back up for those of our listeners who, don't know very much about the role of France, throughout the world in empire, but also particularly in Senegal. Could you give us a sense of this is kind of an impossible task, but a very brief story of France's involvement in Senegal, getting up to this unique situation that you're talking about in the 19th century? When did the French get there? What happened before your story begins in the 1880s?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I'll do a brief thumbnail sketch. So what's interesting about Senegal in particular is that it was both a very old colony. The French first landed on the coast of, what we now know as Senegal and established posts there in the 17th century. And Saint-Louis, which was the capital of Senegal, through most of the colonial period, Dakar became more important and became a regional colonial capital of the French West African Federation. But Saint-Louis was founded in the 17th century. And there were moments in the 18th century when it fell into British hands and so forth. But there was a pretty much constant French presence in Senegal for nearly 300 years before the period, 200 years before the period that I'm looking at. And for much of that period, it was really a coastal presence. The French, established trading posts and towns. And there grew to be an important and very influential Métis population, which came about from unions between, often French traders and African women, known as the signars. And there's actually a lot of fascinating scholarship on these particular women who served often as sort of go-betweens between the French and people in the interior. So there's a long history of contact. There's actually a long history of Catholicism. Catholicism was introduced with these French traders often. And then the institutional church arrived in the coastal towns in the 18th century. And a lot of the Métis, and this is important to the story, a lot of the Métis population became very devoutly Catholic. But the period that I'm looking at, beginning in 1880, is sort of a new departure in that it's the beginning of the so-called scramble for Africa, of course, when much of the continent was divided up in the space of about two decades between the major European powers. And just before that, starting in the 1870s, the French had started to push inland into Senegal and then further inland into, you know, what became a sort of giant French West African Federation. So it's kind of an old colony and a new colony at the same time. There are people living in Senegal who have had, you know, contact with the French for centuries, for generations. And then there are people in the period that I'm looking at who encounter French rule for the very first time. And one other thing I should say, just to mention the electoral institutions, in the 1870s, partially because of lobbying by the Métis and other French commercial interests, people associated often with commercial houses based in Bordeaux and some in Marseille, was lobbying for Africans and the Métis population in those coastal communes, those coastal towns, to vote because the commercial interests wanted they wanted their interests represented more strongly. And so they wanted people in the colony to make their voices heard on these commercial issues, both in the colony itself, but also in the French chamber. And so they successfully managed to acquire those rights for African voters. And that, of course, over the course of time, those interests were no longer necessarily represented, and the African vote began to go in different directions and represent different things. I hope that was clear.
Yeah, no, it's really clear, and it's really helpful just to sort of get us caught up to the place where the book really gets going in the 1880s. And so you've talked about this unique status of the Senegalese population in terms of voting rights, or at least the male population in terms of voting rights. And you also say early on in the book, you point out that the complexities of religion and politics in Senegal, that they weren't just a matter of in this period of the 1880s and, you know, through in the book leading up to the 1940s, this period of the Third Republic, that what's going on in Senegal isn't just a reflection of what's going on in the metropole or in France, but that there's a really unique political and religious landscape on the ground in Senegal. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the complexities of that religious landscape. I mean, we'll get into it in the chapters, but just in general, you mentioned this Métis population that converts, and who else is on the ground in terms of religious affiliations and faith in empire, I guess, to borrow your term.
Right. Well, it is very complex. And what's interesting is that in this period between 1880 and 1940, it's an evolving landscape. And if you listen to the Catholic missionaries that I write about, you know, they see it as a battleground between Islam and Catholicism, to capture a still sizable animist population. Now, Islam had been in parts of Senegal for centuries, but there's a new impetus, a new energy in the second half of the 19th century behind expanding Sufi Muslim brotherhoods. And one of them, which is an indigenous brotherhood, the Mouridia, founder and leader of which is Amadou Bamba, he's most active during this era, sort of late 19th, early 20th century. And he's very successful at winning Muslim converts, and gathering adherents to his brotherhood. And still today in Senegal, I mean, his center, the mosque at Touba, the Mouridia, the Mourid order is still very powerful in Senegal today. And there are also the Tijaniya, they're also also growing in this period. But there's something, you know, and scholars of Islam in Senegal have pointed to how, you know, some of the dislocation brought about by colonial expansion and did help Bamba, you know, sort of gain steam and gather adherents. There's a lot of social dislocation on the ground. At the same time, like I said, there's a Catholic, an increased Catholic missionary effort that really gets going in the mid 19th century. You know, the Catholic missionaries, who are nearly all French, the missionaries I write most about, the Spiritan missionaries, who are given control of Episcopal control of the region by the Vatican, i.e. a Spiritan is always the Bishop of Dakar and is always the chief executive of the church in the region, even though there are members of other congregations such as nuns who are living and working there. It's the Spiritans who hold on to that executive seat and who also man all the parish priest, official offices as parish priests. But they're really anxious to convert animists, you know, before the Muslims get to them, is how they portray it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they see Africa as, you know, in many of them see Africa as Europe, you know, back in the day, back in Roman times. You know, it's our job to start the seeds of, you know, what will be a future Catholic civilization in Africa. And it's important that we get our hands on, you know, these animists and sort of secure them before, you know, they convert to Islam. And so the missionaries are doing two things, really. I mean, there are plenty of Catholics, established Catholics, who are living in those coastal towns, both French and Métis Catholics. But then, you know, where the missionaries serve more is in what we would consider sort of traditional roles as priests in an urban setting. But then they're also out in the bush, and particularly in areas where they think they have a good chance of winning converts from animism. And they do try to convert some Muslims, but they don't have a ton of resources, so they focus more on animist populations.
Well, it is really complicated. And as somebody who knew nothing about any of this, really, except in very vague terms, before reading the book, I was really grateful to you for being able to, you know, manage all of this complexity with so much clarity in the book. It's really quite extraordinary how you do that. You present the book in the introduction, Liz, as a kind of corrective to historical studies that have come before. And much of this seems to be linked to your emphasis on things like these concepts, you know, the heterogeneity of colonial rule, the significance of local agency, and what you refer to, and you have a few different ways of talking about this, but in at least one instance, you talk about this plethora of power brokers, and that notion of a power broker seems very important throughout the book. And I wonder if you could talk about these forces at work on the ground in Senegal and tell us maybe a little bit more broadly about your approach along these lines and the types of prior historical work that the book is in conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And part of this, part of my stance comes out of my own learning, because I think I initially approached the project in the way that I ended up critiquing, in that, you know, I was very interested in the relationship between the French Metropolitan Republic, which had these, you know, supposed universal values of, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity, and secularism in this period. Of course, right smack in the middle of my period is when the law separating church and state is passed in 1905. There's the couple of laws before that, which maybe we'll get into the specifics of, but, you know, there's a real official push for secularism in the Third Republic, and it's sort of held up as laïcité, or secularism is one of the sort of underlying or foundational tenets, supposedly, of the French Third Republic. And so looking at looking at a colony in this context, you know, my original thinking was, oh, well, here we have this republic and it's all about secularism. And how does that work in the colony? And I was thinking very much in terms of, you know, the metropole sort of projecting its values or its, you know, its ethos, its ideology onto this colonial canvas. And I think that's part of what the book ends up reacting to, even though that's in some ways where I started, because I think that there has been a tendency in some respects for people to assume that, you know, particular French values, particular French kind of French civilization, which often does include this secular ethos, that the French brought a particular ethos or civilization with them to Africa, and that their colonies were different as a result, or they colonized differently as a result. And there's a great deal written about a supposed French Republican civilizing mission that, you know, it brought with it these particular values of liberty, equality, fraternity, secularism, etc. And while I don't think anyone believes, you know, this 100% in that the French, you know, came to Africa spouting equality completely, but that there's people have, I think, have accepted the idea that there's something unique about this, that there's something to this Republican civilizing mission, and that it's, you know, it does inform how the French do it, and they do it differently than, say, the British, for example. And I believed that too, but then when I started looking at how complex things were on the ground, you know, it just became hard to define exactly how that supposed civilizing mission was working. In fact, I couldn't find as much evidence of it as I thought I might. I found that, you know, republicanism and secularism, things that I had expected to find in the mouths of colonial administrators, it wasn't as prevalent as I had expected. And instead, what I was looking at, what I was finding, was that colonial rule as it evolved was the product of all of these, the interactions of all of these different power brokers, some of whom are French, some of whom are African, but, you know, and it's not just the administration, the French administration, the official, you know, French government that's a power broker. It's contending with, you know, French missionaries are power brokers, French traders are power brokers, the Métis and the commercial interests, both French and Métis, are power brokers. And of course, all the, you know, African, the Sufi brotherhoods, you know, Africans who hold power in particular locations, you know, before the French established rule. And, you know, there's a whole host of people. And so what French colonial rule ends up looking like is this really complex negotiation between all these different brokers. And so it becomes much harder to talk about this very seamless transfer of French metropolitan ideas to the colonial setting.
It's fascinating how you draw that. You come back to this point again and again in different ways throughout the six chapters. So maybe I can kind of move us to talking about those. And, you know, the chapters are organized in the book chronologically, going from the 1880s right up until 1940. And you sort of talk about those last years right before the French defeat in the conclusion to the book. And the chapters are interesting in the sense that you're telling a story that's unfolding chronologically, but each chapter sort of engages with different themes and issues at the same time as it comes back to some of these central concerns that we've just talked about. So in the first chapter, and, you know, I teach this graduate class on thesis writing and prospectus writing. And one of the things that I notice about the book is that you have these great hooks, right? I want to give these to my students and say, now that's a good hook. So in chapter one, and you do this a few times in the book, You know, the hook is this scandal involving this nun alleged to have become pregnant in the colony in 1886. And so I wonder if you could just even tell us a sort of shorter version of that story of what unfolds and how you sort of use it to get into the themes and issues discussed in the chapter around the interactions between religion and politics in the 1880s in Senegal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So it's funny because when I first came across this story, I didn't completely understand what was going on. You know, you sort of need to get into the sense of humor at the time. And I couldn't understand what the reference meant in the newspaper until I, and then I found archival, you know, the archival pieces around it. But yeah, there's a nun who is accused of being pregnant in a newspaper. It's actually at the time it's the first and only private newspaper that was published in coastal Senegal. Before that, it was only the official colony paper, the Journal Officiel, the colony. There was a blurb that accused this nun of being pregnant, which of course at that time was a really scandalous thing to do, and it threw the four communes, which are the four towns that have the voting rights, threw them into a political and social uproar in the context of ongoing legislative elections. And I use the incident to look at sort of where the Catholic Church is in Senegal at this moment. It had been sort of more closely allied with the colonial administration prior to the early 1880s, when a civilian administration came in and replaced a military one. And it was very influential because it commanded, the Catholic Church was allied with one of the political parties, the Métis political parties, that was most of the members of it were devoutly Catholic. So they're sort of implicated in electoral, you know, in the electoral arena. And the story shows two things. I mean, on the one hand, what ends up happening is the nun who was not pregnant, after much deliberation, her mother superior decides to sue the paper for this slander, and she's victorious. Although the nuns hesitate about this because they think the more exposure this story gets, the worse off we are. You know, we don't mm-hmm. need this in court. We don't really need this, you know, being bandied about in the public sphere for any longer than necessary. And on the other hand, it shows that there's a new, you know, there's some new stuff stirring politically in the communes. The paper that slandered the nun is an attack by a rival Métis party that uses anti-clerical politics that are inspired to some degree by a metropolitan anti-clerical rhetoric to try to attack, you know, its political opponents in the communes. And attack the colonial administration. So it's this opposition party. And the missionaries, the Catholics, are shocked by this because they, you know, it represents this new and frightening challenge. Even though they win out in the end, it spells, you know, a new era is beginning, and there are more players on the scene who are going to affect the political situation. And what's interesting is, and maybe we'll talk about this as we get further into the book, the Métis opposition group, which attacks the nun, they aren't afraid to, at the same time, you know, later on when they see that maybe, you know, anti-clericalism isn't the best approach, they're perfectly willing to embrace Catholicism and the Catholic mission, especially as they see the Catholic mission moving into opposition against the colonial administration. So it's going back to the power broker's idea, where mm-hmm. it's the shifting landscape. And it keeps shifting so quickly in this period. You know, in 30, 35 years later, the Métis are almost politically irrelevant anyway. Once the Black African population actually wins an election outright for itself. So some of this early bickering is starts to look like, oh, you know, you guys don't see the writing on the wall in terms of which power brokers are really going to sort of last here, who are going to emerge as most important. But this is a way of my introducing this very complicated landscape of shifting power brokers and interests.
And the next chapter in the book, Liz, you look at the 1890s and you use, so the first is this allegedly pregnant nun. And then in the second chapter, you use this murder and investigation and trial to talk about this complex interplay between French administrators, missionaries, and these different African groups. And you also move from a discussion of the communes to sort of the French incursions in land. And I wonder if you could talk about that and what some of the issues are and who are the different players involved as you move into the 1890s and as you look at a different sort of geographic region.
Mm-hmm. This is actually my favorite chapter to write and to research. It was just one of those situations where I'm sure, you know, historians will know what I mean, where just archival sources from three different places, you know, just coalesced into this amazing picture that I would never have seen otherwise. I mean, the first time when I looked at the sources, which was when I was doing my dissertation, I only had a couple pages on this trial, this murder trial, because I had found some sources in Dakar and then I had found some in a missionary archive. But it wasn't until I subsequently went to Aix-en-Provence and found the court records that it really came into focus. And it was that, I'll never forget the finding of the court records in Aix-en-Provence. I was jumping up and down at my desk. But so this looks at an area which at the time, now this is still relatively close to the coast, but at the time this was a period, this was an area where the French were expanding. And what's interesting here is the French colonial administration was really expanding into an area where there were already missionaries on the ground. So there were French missionaries there, you know, but then you have this administration moving in and trying to assert its hegemony in the region. And what ended up happening is there were two African groups in the region, the predominantly Muslim Wolof and the predominantly animist Serer, who had long been in conflict. Their conflict had preceded the entry of missionaries and administrators into the region. And the Serer had long sort of resisted being incorporated into the neighboring Wolof kingdoms, and had resisted also converting to Islam, largely because of their rejection of, you know, the Wolof as political overlords. And so from the missionary perspective, I mean, one of the reasons the missionaries are there is because they see the Serer as, oh, great, here are some animists who don't like Muslims. You know, this is a perfect opportunity for us, right? You know, right. And we can go in here and we can find some people who are receptive, and we can also, you know, they really actually talked in terms of creating physical barriers to Islam. So they were hoping that, you know, they could like literally establish a cordon of people, of Catholic people, Catholic Serer, that would sort of keep Islam from spreading, you know, further south in Senegal. So you have antagonism between Wolof and Serer. You have missionaries who want to convert the Serer, who are in place and on the ground in greater numbers than the French administration. And then you have the French administration moving in. And because, of course, the French administration is under-equipped and underfunded, they have to rely a lot on African intermediaries, and they choose to rely on the Wolof in this region. This is a region south of Dakar. south and east of Dakar. And so they appoint as their agents Muslim Wolof, many of whom, you know, I've seen written sources by these people. I mean, many of whom are literate, some of whom had attended French school or had been aristocrats in these Wolof kingdoms. So highly educated in some cases. You know, the French saw them as more reliable, the French administrators. The French administrators saw the Serer as, you know, unruly, brutal, savage peasant villager types. And they saw these Wolof aristocrats as more, you know, civilized, I guess would be the word. So you have a situation where the missionaries are trying to, you know, convert the Serer, but then the French administration comes along and appoints all these Muslim Wolofs as the chiefs, you know, over these Serer populations, which anger the Serer and, of course, anger the missionaries, because the missionaries are worried, oh, well, if they give them, you know, Muslim chiefs, then they're all going to convert to Islam eventually. Mm-hmm. And our work is all in vain. And so there's this fierce competition that develops where the missionaries constantly, you know, sort of undermine the administration in a whole bunch of different ways, and the Wolof chiefs. And one of the cases is this trial where a Serer is accused of murdering a Wolof agent of the administration. And the court, the case actually goes to court in the colony's capital in Saint-Louis. And the chief witness is, in fact, a missionary who testifies that, well, of course, he killed this guy in self-defense because the administration has this terrible policy of appointing Wolof chiefs over these, you know, poor victimized Serer. And this is the outcome. And so the man, the Serer, is acquitted of the murder, which is, a, you know, major uproar, causes a major uproar in the French administration. But it's really interesting because it's a it's never quite clear exactly who's pulling the strings in a lot of these interactions. And the Serer do an excellent job of kind of motivating these French missionaries to go to bat for them against their Wolof chiefs and to, you know, complain to the governor. And, you know, they do a lot. There's a lot of manipulating. Of course, there's some, you know, manipulating on the other end as well. The missionaries, you know, they want to justify what they're doing. So they're, you know, they also, you know, embroil themselves in this conflict in manipulative ways. But it's a really fascinating example of how, you know, these, again, you've got these separate power brokers who are contending for influence and, you know, trying to get their particular, trying to get things as they would like to have it. And it's sort of how colonial rule, you know, how it works in a very, very local level as a product of these contestations.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I have a favorite chapter, but maybe it's mine as well. I think the other thing that about this sort of in a general sense, in terms of what you're getting at in the book, is that this is a chapter that really, well, on the one hand, you know, this earlier conflict that you're, this longstanding conflict that you're talking about between the Wolof and the Serer, you sort of show how that gets mapped onto the conflict between administrators and missionaries, that in fact, that this longer history is there, and then the conflict between administrators and missionaries. I'm not sure if I'm trying to think of the right word, that it sort of reinforces that, and that in fact Africans themselves are agents in all of this. And I wondered if you could say something about, you know, how in this great convergence of sources you got at or tried to get at these issues of African agency. And at one point you talk about how, you know, the priests and the administrators are the loudest voices in the archives, but you did get at some of this issue of African agency and voices in this history. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. And what's interesting is I don't know that I can keep doing this now that the book is out, but it's actually such a fascinating exercise for students that I I have actually translated a bunch of the sources, and I do an exercise. I teach a class on France and Africa, and I actually give the students the sources, and I say to them, okay, you know, write me, I give them snippets, obviously not everything that was in the chapter, but I say, you know, tell me who's in charge here, you know, write me an explanation of what's going on and who's pulling the strings, you know. And it's funny because at the end of the day, you have these passionate advocates for the Wolof chiefs and these passionate advocates for the Serer villagers. And
right.
But yeah, it's, I was lucky in the sense that some of the Wolof, there actually are in the archives in Senegal, there actually are documents from some of these Wolof chiefs, you know, writing to the French administration saying, you know, if this missionary is in charge here, then fine, you know, I'll go somewhere else. What am I supposed to do about this missionary who's telling the Serer villages they don't have to pay me their taxes, kind of thing? So there actually are some concrete sources from Africans, which is pretty rare, right. You know. Now, of course, the Serer, there's nothing in the documentary record that comes directly from a Serer source, except, you know, counting the trial, what we have of the trial records, what's transcribed in the trial records. But, you know, it's possible to read through the French sources. And what's particularly great about this case, like I said, is that there's two French, you know, I've got two French accounts to look at in many of these cases. So, you know, there's the administrative account, which of course has its own biases and flaws. And then there's a missionary account, which has its own problems as well.
Sure.
But held next to each other when they're talking about the same incidents, for example, in a Serer village, you know, then you can really start to, you know, you could start to hear those Serer voices, and you're not, you know, that's one thing that I found so great about doing the research for the book in general is that the missionary sources, as, you know, as flawed as they are, they're so good at throwing the French administrative sources into relief. And so much colonial history is sort of straight out of these, you know, colonial administrative archives. And there's often not a sort of, you know, it's hard to get a different perspective. But that's one thing that really helped in this case is you have these two different French sources, and that can actually help clarify the African picture.
Well, and it's, I mean, and one of the larger, I guess, aims of the book that you talk about again in the conclusion and that really runs throughout the chapters is this notion that, you know, we have a tendency or people have had a tendency to think that missionaries served as, you know, I think you use that term, handmaidens of empire. And that in fact, when we look at these different sources and look at the interests and competing visions, as you say, of Africans and of the civilizing mission and ideas about assimilation and these other things, that in fact, not only that you read can read these sources against one another and also show that in fact, missionaries weren't just working for the administration, or working in service of the administration, that they had their own interests and that they were on the other side or another side of things, either defending their own interests and in some cases, as in the case of this trial, you know, speaking up in defense of an African who had killed someone who was essentially a French agent. Mm-hmm. So that's really fascinating the way you show that in these different cases in the book. You mentioned earlier, Liz, that part of the book, and you get into this in chapter three, that you look at the ways in which legislation, that Third Republic legislation around laïcité and secularism in the early part of the 20th century, in the wake of the Dreyfus Affair of the end of the 19th century, that legislation, well, I guess it's more of a question than a statement, that there is a debate about how that legislation should be applied in the colonial context. And the way in which it should be exported, if at all, to the empire as a whole and to Senegal in particular. So I wonder if we could talk now about, you know, how that all works out in the early 20th century and how these different pieces of legislation, maybe you can even just tell us what they were, and how the transmission or not of these new policies that apply in the metropolitan context how that plays out in the colonial context in Senegal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So yeah, I mean, the middle chapters of the book are both the chapter you're mentioning, which deals with the legislation, and the subsequent chapter on the First World War. I mean, these are the two periods when I feel as though the metropolitan context does sort of impinge more on the colonial scene, although not necessarily in the ways that one would expect, and not entirely. You know, there's a moment, I think I write, when the channels for this legislation are sort of open, that, you know, anti-clericalism is, there's a moment when it looks like anti-clericalism is going to, metropolitan anti-clericalism is going to come ashore in Senegal. But then there's a whole host of factors that end up mitigating that. Some of that is activism on the ground by people in the colony, a whole host of different measures, you know, sort of trying to blunt things like the laicization of schools and hospitals. But then also on the part of high-ranking colonial officials who start to become, you know, skeptical of the idea of implementing metropolitan law for a variety of reasons. And so in this case, we're talking about the triumvirate of the so-called anti-clerical laws, which, as you said, came into force in the wake of the Dreyfus Affair in France. And were really, you know, when they were conceived of and promulgated, were really aimed at the Catholic Church. Of course, these laws, and maybe we'll talk about this later, these laws have come up again, and the law of 1905 in particular, separating church and state, have come up again in recent years in the context of the place of Islam in France. But they were aimed at Catholics and at Catholic congregations in particular. A congregation is a word we might use for a Catholic order, like the Dominicans, or in my mm-hmm. case, the Spiritans. Some of whom had been very, very vocal during the Dreyfus Affair, very anti-Dreyfusard, very critical of the Republic. And these laws were aimed at punishing, at least to some degree, at punishing these congregations. And so there's a 1901 law on associations, which is a government attempt to sort of to establish more control over organizations such as congregations. There's a 1904 law on congregations that regulates congregations, and then there's the famous one on in 1905 on officially separating church and state and ending all state funding for Catholic schools or, you know, Catholic enterprises of any kind. And there's a big debate about whether this should be applied in the empire. And there's a commission that's set up in France called the Dissler Commission, which starts meeting actually before they pass the third law, the separation of church and state. They start looking at the first two laws, laws of 1901 and 1904, to figure out, you know, does it make sense to apply this, legislation in the colonies? And if so, are we just applying it to Catholics, or are we going to apply it to all the different religions that are in the colonies? And if we're going to do that, you know, how do we do that, et cetera? And it becomes this fascinating discussion in the case of Senegal. Becomes a fascinating discussion, a sort of three-way discussion between the governor of Senegal, the governor general of French West Africa, who is the executive that oversees the entire French West African Federation, of which Senegal is only one colony. There are eight colonies in the Federation. And then this commission in Paris, these high-ranking individuals in Paris who are sort of, you know, charged with setting policy from the top down. And they raised some really fascinating questions, which, you know, when I was reading this stuff from this era, made me think, I mean, some of the questions they're raising are things you're hearing in the French media today, which, you know, are Muslim, is Islam comparable, for example, to Catholicism in terms of,
right.
you know, can it be treated the same way before the law? Can a Muslim be a Frenchman? You know, there's all sorts of, now these themes run throughout the book, but you're having these explicit discussions. You know, it did remind me of some of the stuff I was hearing, you know, in France in the early 2000s. Is a headscarf the same thing as a cross? You know, and can we compare this, and does it make sense to try to apply this legislation, which, you know, was clearly written with Catholics in mind? Should we, with Catholic congregations in mind, should we apply it to these other religions? And, you know, it's a very intricate discussion. I don't want to, you know, bore everyone with the details, but it goes back and forth. And it's funny because it doesn't really necessarily make sense. In the beginning, the executives in, you know, in the colony are sort of taking it, oh, sure, you know, apply the law or whatever, even though there are actually laws on the books in the colony that give the governor really wide ranging powers over religious organizations that would actually in some ways be curtailed by this legislation. But they seem not to really be aware of that. This is one of the interesting things, too. You start to see how how this colonial, you know, some of this colonial structure of power is, you know, it's sometimes manned by people that don't even understand exactly what their powers are. But by the end of the discussion, which it concludes a couple years after the separation of church and state in 1907, the executives on the ground, in the same people who were talking about this, you know, a few years earlier, are passionately arguing that, no, we shouldn't have legislation. We need to keep our, you know, keep our hands free to do what we need to do on the ground. And we don't want, you know, to be encumbered by metropolitan law. And furthermore, Muslims, you know, there's this sort of heightened fear, I think, of what applying this to Muslims might mean. And maybe this will, and you know, this will result in unrest or terrorism or, you know, so forth and so on. So it's a very bizarre discussion, but I think it kind of reflects, it reflects to a certain degree, you know, how unclear everybody was on, you know, what is exactly the relationship to the people in the empire. And there is no clear ideology that holds sway. Again, going back to the point about the civilizing mission and the Republican secularism, you end up with some application in some colonies, you know, in some respects. You end up in Algeria with application except for exemption for Muslim clerics who have supported the regime, that an exception that's renewed over and over and over again until the 1940s. You end up with this crazy patchwork where, you know, this supposed unshakable, you know, ideal of laïcité is completely compromised and changed and altered. So it kind of goes to my point again of power brokers and exceptions and cobbling together a kind of crazy quilt of imperial governance.
It's really fascinating, and given the sort of certainty with which some of these laws are at least attempted in their applications more recently, it's really interesting to look at this historical case where things were so complicated, and in fact there was so much compromise necessitated by things on the ground. So I find those connections really fascinating, and I'm glad you brought them up. You move on in the later chapters in the book to talking about the impact of the First World War, and then the building of Dakar's colonial cathedral of the Souvenir Africain. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how the war, as another kind of external force, with demands coming from the metropole, runs through the colony and the impact that it has on these interactions between religion, politics, and colonial authority.
Sure. Yeah, the war is well, it's significant on many levels, and Senegal really the toll on the people of Senegal, and particularly African. I mean the African population in particular is extremely high in terms of casualty rates. As you know, as many people, it's become very visible in the last few years. You know, tens of thousands of West Africans were, the French use the word recruited, like right. conscripted. I mean, I, when I was writing this, I kept trying to think of how to convey recruited in the sense that I meant, which in many cases meant, you know, recruited was a forceful thing. It was a conscription, you know, in some cases almost an enslavement. But the, Africans, you know, went in large numbers, to fight, in the metropole. And their casualty rates were very high. On the other hand, many of them that came back, you know, they had seen France, and there's people who've written about this very, very eloquently. You know, war veterans who came back had, you know, new aspirations. They'd seen Europe. They'd fought on, you know, equal footing against Europeans. They wanted particular, you know, gains. They wanted particular concrete gains as a result of that. That's one of the, you know, that's one of the backstories. I really focus on the missionary stance in this period, because it's very interesting. I mean, the missionaries sort of make a career in some ways out of, you know, defending Africans against what they see as a rapacious administration. But this is one case where they sort of shut their mouths, even though privately they are, you know, writing to each other about how horrified they are by the policies of the administration that's, you know, coming around and taking Africans off to war, and the ways in which the quote unquote recruitment is handled, where, you know, African chiefs will single out the people they don't like in their community and take them in chains to the the French army post. But the calculation on the part of missionaries is that this is our chance to show that, you know, we are patriots. I mean, one of the things that's running through their arguments through this whole period is that they are better French patriots and they are better sort of French civilizers than the administration, that they are the sort of the true French civilizers in Africa. They are the ones who are teaching Africans, you know, the values of Europe. You know, in their case, of course, this is linked indissolubly to Catholicism. And they've been arguing, even in the chapter where I described with the murderer case, even though they benefit from the fact that the administration policies are oppressing the Serer population, and so the missionaries kind of get closer to the Serer by acting as their defenders, they're still arguing that it would just be better if the administration would just support Catholic proselytization wholesale and help them convert. Okay. And so this is for them a big chance to show that we're patriots and we care about France, and okay, we're not gonna protest, even though we're completely horrified about how things are unfolding. And not only that, we're really going to celebrate, you know, our patriotism through the launching of this this cathedral project, I have a chapter on the war and then a chapter on the cathedral project. The cathedral project starts in a few years before the war. The bishop at the time, the missionary bishop, conceives of it as a patriotic monument to all the French soldiers, administrators, missionaries, traders, etc., who died for France in Africa, you know, who gave their lives so that France could colonize Africa. And then the First World War interrupts the project, and it then becomes an even bigger memorial for all the Africans who then died for France. So it sort of it becomes more emblematic of this reciprocal relationship. But it's a very aggressively patriotic gesture by this Catholic mission to really try to show this administration, which has never fully, you know, embraced the Catholic mission, that they are real French patriots and that they know best, basically, you know, how to deal with colonization, how to colonize, how to relate to Africans. It's kind of, you know, going back to the handmaiden point, it's like they want to be handmaidens. But
the administrators won't let them.
Right. And one of the key points is it's not because the administrators are, you know, ideologues, secularizing ideologues. There's a whole bunch of different reasons, but, you know, they see mm-hmm. the missionaries as, you know, in this case of the Serer, they're meddling, they're contesting administrative authority over Africans. They're interfering with tax collection. They're testifying in court on behalf of Africans. They're, you know, the reasons change over time. By the end of the book, one of the chief complaints in the interwar period by administrators is that, you know, missionaries are giving Africans aspirations that are dangerous to the colonial order. They're, you know, teaching Africans, well, if they convert, they're just like, they're just like Frenchmen. And, you know, the missionaries are actually arguing that they should be judged according to Christian law or according to French law, you know, which administrators see as this is problematic. We don't want a bunch of African Catholics thinking that they're suddenly, you know, entitled to special rights and privileges. So there's a whole host of different reasons, but the administration just never quite buys this missionary patriotic push, which really centers around the first World War.
So you talk about Liz, you talk about the conversion of Africans to Catholicism in the last chapter of the book, and you've raised the issue already of this sort of theme of, you know, how to handle converts, how the French administration thinks about assimilation and about Africans differently than missionaries. And I wonder if you could just tell us even just some information, like how many converts to Catholicism were there? How successful were missionaries in the Senegalese context? And, you know, how does this all come back to this point about the heterogeneity of French rule?
Mm-hmm. Well, the short answer to your question in terms of was it successful is not very.
Right.
And I mean, there are myriad reasons for that. And some of them have to do with missionaries' own flaws and their own. Now, I argue in the book that they hew more closely to their to an ideological vision than do administrators, you know, and in you know their Catholic vision of a civilizing mission. But there's also real, you know, limitations to that, and one of the ways in which that becomes evident is that they're terrible at training African priests to take over in African communities. I mean, these French priests, men, most of them want to keep authority over Africans. There's also, you know, this is also a power relationship. And it's one thing to convert people. It's another to sort of hand them the keys to the church. And this is a problem throughout. This is a phenomenon throughout Africa and something that the Vatican and in the British Protestant Church is also constantly hammering home to their missionaries, which is, you know, the whole point of this is to create an African church. But, you know, a lot of these missionaries are, in fact, racist and don't think right. that these Africans can be in charge. And so that does, you know, that's one of the big one of the reasons that they're not as successful as they could be. There's a host of other ones. We're talking in terms of conversions. you know, in the period, of course, this is very, these numbers are so hard to pin down.
Sure.
And they're coming out of Catholic sources where, you know, you need to be skeptical. But we're talking in the tens of thousands over this period. We're not, you know, there are other colonies. It's interesting. There are other areas in French-controlled Africa where missionaries do much better. And even the same groups of missionaries. Islam is also, I mean, it's a huge factor in the fact that they're competing with well-established, you know, Muslim and expansionist Muslim competitors has a lot to do with it as well. But what's interesting is that, you know, they do, two African populations I end up talking about a lot, the Serer, whom I mentioned before, and the Jola, which are animist population in the Casamance. They do, you know, these are the two areas in Senegal today where Catholicism is still very important. And Leopold Senghor, who was the first president mm-hmm. of independent Senegal, is a Catholic Serer, who went to mission school. I saw his, you know, equivalent of his sixth grade, you know, report card in the archives. And and when he went on to, of course, and he was brilliant. I mean, he went on to distinguish himself in high school, before going to France for his higher education. And the missionaries were so proud of him, you know, when he went off to high school, not a Catholic high school, but went off to high school, in Dakar, I believe. And they were so proud because he was so, you know, they said, this reflects well on us, you know, because we're the ones who, you know, who taught him in the beginning. So even though Catholics are a tiny minority in Senegal today, they're still very influential. And because of the mix of ethnic groups in Senegal, you know, I mean, the Muslim Wolof are dominant demographically, but, you know, the Catholic Jola and Serer populations are also very important. And, you know, Senegal still prides itself today on being a stable, you know, cosmopolitan kind of place where, you know, people of different faiths, different ethnicities can coexist in a democracy. I mean, of course, there were some threats to that in the last year or two, which seem to have been surmounted. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting part of the identity of the modern, you know, of the country as it is today, of the independent country.
Do you think the study that you've offered us here, you mentioned that, you know, you got interested in this, in these, some of these issues during the period of the Stasi Commission. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on how looking at the intricacies of this religious landscape, thinking about empire, thinking about religion, thinking about these questions of assimilation and civilization, that are there lessons from this story that you tell from the late 19th to the mid 20th century for some of these issues? I know this is a huge question, but if you want to say anything about issues of secularism in France currently, and the legacies of empire, like, do you see connections between the work you've done here and the ways that some of those questions continue to resonate in France today?
Oh, I definitely do. I don't know if I want to pronounce on any lessons. I think there are three ways in which this study, or three ways that I, you know, that really strike me in ways in which this study connects to, you know, more contemporary issues. I mean, the first is indeed this question of religious politics in France today, you know, which is directly a legacy of empire because, you know, many of the immigrant populations, Muslim population in particular, you know, is an immigrant or former immigrant population from the former colonies. I don't have any words of wisdom on where this should head. But I mean, one of the things that I learned, and especially in that chapter about the metropolitan legislation, is that, you know, and other scholars have said this more eloquently than I have, but, you know, laïcité, again, which has often been treated as this sort of immutable, you know, ever, ever unchanging principle of French republicanism is something that, you know, was created in a particular historical context, you know, negotiated by particular interests. And that continues to be the case. And so sometimes it's invoked today, you know, in relation, for example, to headscarves or to the niqab or, you know, whatever the issue du jour is, which usually is a, you know, pertains to Muslim observance in France. You know, people who invoke it on both sides of the issue, I think, as this kind of immutable principle that stands outside of history. I mean, that's just not the case. Both when it's created and then, you know, what was interesting for me is seeing these first tentative discussions about how does La Laïcité relate to Islam in, you know, in this imperial context, and getting this huge range of answers. And, you know, it'd be fascinating for someone to actually do a study on the whole of, you know, I was really focusing on the Senegalese case and the French West African case, but, you know, if you check the empire as a whole and look at, you know, how the Dussler Commission was thinking about, you know, this secularizing legislation, you know, it's really fascinating. Sort of all the different jockeying and exceptions and negotiations. So, I mean, that's one thing I think is to keep in mind that secularism is something that, you know, the fact that it's considered to be this immutable principle is itself a historical, itself has, right. You know, has its own history, I guess. So that's one thing, although I don't have any specific recommendations on what
I won't put that pressure on you.
So that's the first, you know, that's the first area. And, you know, I was just so struck by some of the things that I found in my sources that I felt like I could have torn from the pages of French, you know, newspapers today. You know, you've got the Catholic bishop in 1892 in Dakar shouting that we're never going to make a Frenchman out of a Muslim. You know, I mean, when are you going to realize that this just isn't incompatible thing? So, you know, and it was just striking to see that, oh, wow, okay, this is Senegal in 1892 as opposed to France in 2003. But, you know, there's definitely some interesting connections there. The second thing that I think it relates to in terms of the contemporary scene is the ongoing, often fraught relationship between France and Africa, which is something I touch on in my teaching to a certain degree. But, you know, it's something I think in America we don't necessarily have as much perspective or visibility on. The areas of Africa that are in the former French Empire are not necessarily on our radar screen, I think, as much. They are now, actually. I mean, of course, with this recent violence in Mali and then right. the French military action there, that has suddenly, you know, as suddenly when there seems to be a terror threat, you know, the American government are become focused on the region. But the history of France in this part of Africa post-independence, you know, there is a continuing history there. There are many ways in which the relationships are still very important, both between governments and, you know, in the case of this book, in between churches, and I'll get to that in a second, you know, between Catholicism, you know, in Africa and in Europe. I just think we don't, as Americans, we don't always pay attention to that. It's much more visible in France. And I've traveled extensively in this part of the world. It is certainly very visible on the ground, and it works through different channels now. You know, there's trade, there's development, but there's also a lot of political wrangling around, say, immigration policy. Right. You know, and I was actually in Senegal when President Bush visited in 2003, which was actually very bizarre. I mean, suddenly all the beggars were gone from the streets of Dakar. I don't know where, you know, I mean, it was it was crazy. But I was talking with some people who said, well, you know, one person was arguing, well, this is good. You know, America's going to pay attention to Senegal. And maybe this is a way to kind of pry ourselves loose from the French. And then the, you know, other side of the argument was, you know what, the French know who we are and where we are. And as much as, you know, as much as frustrating as the relationship with France can be, we know that we're going to get aid, you know, from the, we're going to get, you know, monetary aid, we're going to get assistance, you know, that if we have to place a bet on the United States or on France going forward as a global partner, France is the safer bet, even though, yes, there's the, you know, the continuing, you know, imbalance of power and frustration about the colonial past, the sense is that it's a safer bet. The Americans aren't going to care who we are, you know, a couple years down the road. So, I mean, that's something, that's something too. I mean, that I think about in terms of what are some of the connections to the present day. And the last thing is, and this is something I'm actually working on now, is, you know, the fate of the church in Africa, and the fact that now, of course, in Senegal, like I said, the fate of the church is not as good as it is elsewhere. But what struck me, you know, I've spent a lot of time in these obscure Catholic archives in Rome and in France and various other places, and so many of the clergy in Europe now are actually African. There's been this huge sort of flow. You know, there was a huge flow of Europeans, and particularly the French. The French were the, you know, missionaries par excellence in the late 19th, early 20th century. Huge flow of French missionaries out into the world, into the French Empire and elsewhere. And now there's this huge flow back of Africans into European churches, both into missionary congregations. All of these missionary congregations that I describe, they're now at least, you know, their population taken by country of origin. They have hundreds of African members now. And in some cases, they're almost majority African members because they can't recruit priests in France anymore. And then even parish priests. I was in Sancerre last summer, and met, you know, the local, this actually local Protestant minister was Congolese. But, you know, this is increasingly, it's interesting, like for all of the, difficulty, you know, the church encountered in Africa, in some ways, this is the most enduring, one of the most important enduring connections, of the colonial era. And one of the ways in which there's still, you know, a lot of, exchange and, you know, travel between Europe and Africa is through these religious institutions. And you saw, of course, with the Pope, the election of the new Pope this year. I mean, there was all this excitement that it was a Pope from the third world. Now, there was, of course, there had been rumors that it was going to be an African. And I know lots of people who were disappointed when it wasn't. But still, the fact that the Catholic Church went outside of Europe, you know, and picked somebody that was, you know, quote unquote, you know, from the third world. I mean, it showed, you know, the direction that the church is moving, and it's, you know, it's becoming less of a European institution. So I think that's interesting too. It's a pretty remarkable transformation when you had, even as recently as the 40s and 50s, just handfuls of African priests. And now, you know, there's this, now these African priests are sort of, you know, they're being called to Europe to help because you can't find any Europeans who want to be priests anymore, at least in Western Europe.
It's really fascinating, those legacies of the book. Well, Liz, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I'm glad that you got to this issue of, you know, what you're working on now, because that's usually a question that I ask towards the end. But I guess this is just the time for me to say thank you so much for writing the book and for agreeing to talk with me about it today. And I've really, really enjoyed speaking with you and hearing more about the project and how it all came together.
Great. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciated having the opportunity to talk about it. I'm glad somebody cares.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And just in terms of those connections that you've made, I think our listeners will find that it's, you know, not just a book about the 19th and first part of the 20th century, and not just one about Senegal, but that has broader implications. And that's really fascinating. Thanks so much, Liz.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.